The natives can't benefit from the resources in their land, but other agents do. And unfortunately, it is often foreign agents who enable these weapons to get into the hands of these people. And so that it's almost a system of divide and rule. Yeah. But of course, you know, if you're a politician in Africa and you're accepting bribes from foreign agents to create conflict and strife in your own country, that's a decision only you can make. Nobody holds a gun to your head to do that. So it comes to issues around personal integrity and so on and so forth.
That's a really interesting point, but I'm afraid we'll have to move on just for the time being.
My name is Julius Arile from Kenya. 6 years ago, being a warrior, fighting with another people from our country. But this time now, I am an athlete and I can run a marathon.
He really does need to make a breakthrough. And if he doesn't have it, then it's going to be harder to fulfill this kind of dream of being in New York as an elite, top elite athlete that could maybe make it in the top five.
Good morning and welcome to Prague, Czech Republic, for the 19th running of the Volkswagen Prague Marathon.
A great race starting in Prague's Old Town Square in this historic city.
So really is very much the underdog character in this documentary, and you really find yourself rooting for him. He has a lot of pressure on himself to prove himself, and he dreams of being on the wall, as he says, of all the top runners of Kenya. And we see him come seventh place in the first race, and then, but then do really well in the second opportunity he has. What did you make of this sort of triumphant arc he had?
Yeah, I mean, you know, I guess when you're choosing your characters to focus on at the beginning of a journey, you have no idea, actually, are they going to make it and stuff. So I think it's less, it sounds a cliche, but it's less about the destination than the journey. It's fascinating to follow this particular man on his sort of athletics career. Now, if he, you know, ends up winning a gold medal at the Olympics, even more extraordinary. But actually, I find it more interesting when you see the real struggles and the person who isn't necessarily going to be the ultimate victor in this. The film really made me think about an American documentary called Hoop Dreams from the 1990s, which followed two young inner-city kids who wanted to be basketball stars. Now, neither of them end up making it, but what you get is a fascinating portrait of their environment and the world that they're in and the politics and the social disadvantages, and actually, that's a more illuminating and, I think, more fascinating storyline than just, you know, the underdog who comes from nowhere to, you know, in the last minute, you know, storms to the front and wins the medal. That's interesting, but I'm more interested in the sort of the world that shapes their, you know.
Of course, he's plagued by poverty and injuries and not the same opportunities. Tete, I see you agreeing with Lee there?
Absolutely. The journey's fascinating. And none of these characters are pristine. Arile got somebody pregnant when she was quite young. It led to her suicide and led to him becoming a warrior. Then later on, he's now got three wives and children by all of them. So if he's not able to take that, put each one of his problems in some kind of compartment, he won't be able to pursue his dream. So these dreams are always fraught. And actually, the story, as you say very well, is the compromises, you know, the calls that each person has to make to pursue what it is that they're really after, and an illumination of the environment within which all of this is going on.
I want to talk now about the parallels we see between Kenya and the US, sort of the Western world. Lee, what did you make of their journey, of Arile's journey to New York, and sort of the observations and comments he was making?
Yeah, I mean, you know, it's very much sort of fish out of water stuff, right? So, you know, where they've grown up, where they live, what they're used to is obviously a world away from, you know, the slightly, you know, the more glamorous, the more professional, the more kind of money at stake world that they go into. But I think, again, what's really interesting is in their own world as well, you see the way that they're not quite fitting in and the problems that they have. And to be honest, I would have liked the film to touch more on that. Like Tete says, they have these very checkered family lives. That's not really grappled with in the way that I would have you know, appreciated a bit more. And I feel that, you know, of course the thread is the running and the marathon and what happens, but actually to get to know them even a bit more as characters and get a sort of a more rounded portrait of them, I would have liked to hear more about those sort of difficulties with the families and the wives and the kids, because it obviously has an impact. He wants to earn money so he can go back and provide for them, but we don't necessarily get, you know, the full story about what that entails.
And Teta, isn't it quite sad, though, that this notion of success, we see Arile move to sort of a shack-like accommodation, and he thinks he's living in a European city. Why is that this connection of success is linked to Europe and the West?
Well, success is always relative to what you've got. I mean, this guy wasn't having three baths a week out in the bush, and he's suddenly in a shack with running water. I mean, that's luxury. He might as well, from his point of view, be at the Ritz Hotel. So it's absolutely relative. But what I think it's important for people to also think about is the fact that this can be quite corrupting. This kind of drive to live in that star-spangled environment can be quite corrupting, because we all know that the industry that he's now becoming a part of, the elite athletics industry, is also incredibly corrupt.
Which is mainly dominated, sort of, as we see, by Western physiotherapists and management types.
Sure. It's incredibly corrupt. So it's really a story about how, you know, man has to try and make it, making moral judgments at every turn of the way, in a not-so-easy world.
I'm afraid we'll have to leave it there, gentlemen. Thank you very much for joining Doc Review. And that's it for this episode of Doc Review. Thank you to both my guests and to you. I've been Camila Shambayati.
Our voice comes from the heart of beautiful Iran. IRIB English Radio.
Limelight. What unites all settler colonial regimes, but particularly the US and Israel, is the commonality of structural racism, says Binay Bland, political commentator, in an article titled Evictions in Sheikh Jarrah. If housing is a human right, whose rights really matter? Stay tuned for more. In 1948, the United States signed the Universal Declaration of Human Rights, UDHR, acknowledging satisfactory housing as part of the human right to an adequate standard of living. Nevertheless, soon after the recent end of the moratorium, evictions slowly began to rise. What unites all settler colonial regimes, but particularly the US and Israel, is the commonality of structural racism. Indeed, the latest uprising in Palestine stemmed from efforts to evict residents of Sheikh Jarrah in order to replace them with Israeli settlers. ¶¶ It is this structural racism on the part of the Zionist regime that lends the liberation struggle to its international anti-colonial cast. Observers Onye Snow Chatoyer, an organizer with the African People's Revolutionary Party and the All-African Women's Revolutionary Union, an editor with Hood Communist, also serving on the National Committee of the Ven Saramos Brigade, said, "From the very first days of its birth, born from a wave of African and indigenous blood, the United States has built its empire on the backs of the masses of poor and colonized people inside and outside of its borders. According to the Eviction Lab, nearly one in four black renters lives in a country in which the black eviction rate is more than double the white eviction rate. Moreover, formal eviction proceedings are only a part of the problem. As Sophie Kasowicz notes, many tenants are illegally locked out or their utilities are shut off, thus forcing them to leave their homes." A case in point drawn from a forthcoming press release and Facebook post on February 5th, 2022, Asaneta Nekormotore, a long-term community organizer in Philadelphia, an anti-Zionist friend of Palestine, received a 30-day notice to vacate the home that she had been renting for several years. A short time later, some of the new owner's family members started moving in a while. She's still in the house, using a fraudulent lease with different language than the one she signed. The new owner declared that Nekormotore is now a month-to-month housemate, confined to the bedroom rather than the entire house. Nekormotore said, "We need a stronger good cause legislation in Philadelphia. Without it, landlords can sell their property, make a tremendous profit, and push renters out using a move-in eviction, where the new tenant moves in while the current tenant is still there, using implied threats and other forms of intimidation to force the current tenant out. This is very dangerous and has a great potential for violence." In the United States, tenants like Nekormotore have access to the legal system, albeit that it often does not work in their favor. In Sheikh Jarrah, where Ramzi Barut reports that Israel uses the law to ethnically cleanse Palestinians, there is no such recourse to the courts. As Barut points out, this most recent ethnic cleansing has a long history, justified through a series of laws unique to Israel, laws that give a legal cover to outright theft and land robbery. Indeed, after month-long physical and legal battle to avoid eviction, four Palestinian residents of Sheikh Jarrah received the Zionist regime's court's decision that could stay in their homes for 15 years as protected residents. As such, they were required to pay the new Jewish owners a biennial sum of 2,400 shekels, amounting to $743. There are major differences between illegal evictions in Al-Quds neighborhoods as a cover for ethnic cleansing and rising evictions in the states. Nevertheless, what unites them is communal resistance to what Chiotter describes as settler colonial violence. From Gaza to Al-Quds and the West Bank, Palestinians participated in what came to be known as the Unity Intifada. This unity eclipses Fatah and Hamas and all the rest, wrote Barood, adding, because without a united people, there can be no meaningful resistance, no vision for liberation, no struggle for justice to be won. Moreover, Barood contends that the uprising that was instigated by the ethnic cleansing of Sheikh Jarrah was but a microcosm of a larger issue. The ongoing atrocities in Palestine date back to 1948 and continue to this day, but so does the resistance. In Philadelphia, friends responded to Nkorma Touré's call on social media for support in the face of eviction by intimidation. On February 7th, she wrote, if you want to witness a possible illegal move in eviction, come to my house tomorrow, Monday, February 7th. A group of supporters has been present since Monday, February 7th, and will continue to support her as she faces move-out intimidation. As in Palestine, the response was communal. Members of the Poor People's Army and Friends, who represented various activist organizations, arrived to ensure Nkorma Touré's safety. Another commonality is that she represents only one case study of infringement on housing rights of people all over the country, a crisis that looms larger as landlords seek to obtain high rents in a booming housing and rental market. In Palestine, the motive behind evictions is ethnic cleansing. In the U.S., it is disregard for what are considered disposable people whose rights matter less in a capitalist economy than those who reap high profits. What unites them is global resistance movements to settler colonial regimes. This kind of solidarity is crucial to Palestine's liberation. While Palestinians have proved that they are quite capable of saving themselves, collaboration with the Global South, which includes Black Americans, is an important step in the liberation struggle towards freedom.
The wildfires in Greece, Turkey, the United States.
Palestinian prisoners in Israeli jails continue to engage in hunger strikes.
Kim Yo-jong, the powerful sister of North Korean leader.
On the news line.
Britain has sought to restore its influence and colonial rule in West Asia by pursuing aggressive and interventionist policies in the region. UK's first direct military involvement, the 21st century, began in Afghanistan following the 9/11 attacks. UK officials beat the drums of war. Then Prime Minister Tony Blair, who was referred to as George W. Bush's poodle, played a key role in paving the way for UK's militarism. It has now emerged that British forces committed war crimes in Afghanistan. Documents show senior military officers buried evidence that British troops were executing detainees in Afghanistan. UK Special Forces officers killed unarmed Afghans who posed no threats. In 2003, London followed Washington's lead in accusing Iraq's former regime of possessing weapons of mass destruction.
So that was the UK's role, was to provide cover for the Americans. And of course, the Americans, the UK sees America as a means of getting a sort of protection, getting the big brother on their side, which they've, you know, following on from their experiences in 1945, the British establishment have a terrific fear of being left on their own to face a major continental enemy.
the UK alongside the US invaded Iraq without the UN mandate. British forces were primarily stationed in southern Iraq. British soldiers tortured hundreds of Iraqi detainees between 2003 and 2009, but no action was taken to hold the British government accountable for the war crimes that it committed there. Following the invasion of Iraq, an inquiry team was set up to investigate Britain's military intervention in the Arab nation. The Chilcot report said the UK chose to invade Iraq before peaceful options had been exhausted. It also said the former UK Premier, Blair, exaggerated the threat posed by Saddam Hussein. It also said that Blair ignored warnings on what would happen in Iraq after its invasion.
We have concluded that the UK chose to join the invasion of Iraq before the peaceful options for disarmament had been exhausted. Military action at that time was not a last resort.
London is one of Saudi Arabia's staunch supporters. UK-made weapons are used by the Saudi regime against the Yemeni people. The UK is one of Saudi Arabia's leading arms suppliers, along with the US. It is also a major supplier of arms to the United Arab Emirates, another country in the coalition that is bombing Yemen. The UK has continued to support airstrikes by Saudi Arabia and its coalition partners. It has provided both arms and ongoing maintenance and support, in spite of overwhelming evidence of repeated breaches of international humanitarian law by the coalition.
Well, its colonial interest is historical. I don't believe that anyone is trying to get Lawrence of Arabia back into the peninsula anymore. I don't think the British, even the most purblind British, don't think they can recreate the empire.
The UK-made equipment used in the war includes Typhoon and Tornado aircraft, Paveway bombs, and Brimstone and Storm Shadow missiles. The published value of UK arm licenses for export to the Saudi-led coalition since the bombing began in 2015, in March, is £8.4 billion. However, estimates show that the real value of arms to Saudi Arabia is over £20 billion, while the value of sales to the coalition as a whole is over £22 billion.
Such hideous weaponry, and we are actually inviting oppressive regimes and dictatorships to come and buy this weaponry, knowing that it will be used against the people of Palestine, knowing it's going to be dropped on the heads of the people of Yemen, is appalling.
It is now believed that given the U.S. withdrawal from the West Asia region, or minimal presence, the U.K. is moving in to replace the U.S. while pursuing to restore its colonial influence and role in the West Asia region.
Around a month ago, Israeli media reported that the Lebanese resistance movement, Hezbollah, has increased its drone activities in Israeli airspace. The drone operations were mainly for gathering intel. Last Friday, the Israeli military activated the Iron Dome and scrambled fighter jets, but failed to intercept a drone from Lebanon. As a result, air raid sirens were sounded in the north, and later it was announced that Israeli fighter jets were spotted flying low over Beirut. Hezbollah later released a statement saying the drone named Hassan entered Israeli airspace on a reconnaissance mission at a depth of 70 kilometers for around 40 minutes before returning untouched. This was the second incident in as many days and comes after Hezbollah's Secretary General Hassan Nasrallah said the group was making its own drones in Lebanon. Pointing to Israeli threats, the Hezbollah chief said the enemies only threaten others with war, but they know it will be very difficult and costly for them. He said Hezbollah is capable of upgrading the quality of its rockets to fend off Israeli threats. In fact, Hezbollah has been increasing its fleet of unmanned aerial vehicles, and now it is estimated to have some 2,000 UAVs. Based on Israeli media reports, Hezbollah is also in possession of over 100,000 rockets, and Israel's existing missile systems neither are capable of intercepting such a number of missiles and rockets, nor can protect Israeli settlers. The launch of the radio-controlled aircraft on Friday seems like a message from Hezbollah. Even if the Israeli military sometimes manages to shoot down Hezbollah's UAVs or drones, the resistance movement can keep sending them into Israel at will. If Israel believes it is free to violate Lebanese sovereignty with UAVs and fighter jets, Hezbollah will do the same south of the border.
It is interesting to see how fragile its entire military industrial complex actually is, and the latest event has just showed it once again. that even though the Israeli regime is investing so many efforts and its so-called defense, it remains very weak, and it is the Lebanese resistance that continues to show the Israeli regime its own weakness.
Previously, retired Israeli General Yitzhak Brek warned that the Israeli military is not ready for any future war, especially a multi-front one. He predicted that in an extreme scenario, the resistance movements in Syria, Yemen, and Iraq, as well as Hamas in the Gaza Strip, will launch missiles and drones at Israel, so that the average number of rockets fired at the regime will reach 3,000 a day. Atuit reports during the Israel-Palestine conflict in May, when Israel's official military data indicated that the Iron Dome only destroyed fewer than half of the rockets and mortars fired by Hamas and Islamic Jihad resistance movements toward Israel. Therefore, in case of an all-out war, the Israeli regime would be vulnerable. While Tel Aviv sees its power waning, the resistance front has managed to increase its prowess. This is while Israel is trying to sell the Iron Dome missile system to Arab nations, but how can the Iron Dome work for them when it did not work for Israel?
This is why the entire existence of the so-called State of Israel in its current form necessitates the ongoing killing of people and ongoing expansion of its military complex. But at the same time, of course, it remains fragile. This is a very existential contradiction within the Israeli colony that eventually will also probably lead to its to the fall of the apartheid regime and the Israeli hegemony, supposed hegemony in the region.
The editor-in-chief of Rayal Yom newspaper, Abdelbari Atwan, says a small drone that is worth only $100 manages to penetrate into Israel's airspace. Despite the Tel Aviv regime's costly military equipment and the Iron Dome system, he says Persian Gulf Arab states that are racing to buy this system from Israel should give it a second thought after the regime's failure against the Hezbollah resistance movement's drones. World leaders participated in the 58th Munich Security Conference in Germany, which is held annually. This year's conference was dominated by the Ukraine crisis, as major Western powers accused the Kremlin of zeroing in on an imminent invasion of Ukraine. In the conference, the U.S. Vice President, Kamala Harris, announced that Washington and its allies will impose significant and unprecedented economic costs on Russia if it further invades Ukraine.
We will impose far-reaching financial sanctions and export controls. We will target Russia's financial institutions and key industries.
Harris also added the U.S. will not stop with economic measures, but will further reinforce the eastern flank of NATO. Harris said some 6,000 additional service members are already deployed to Romania, Poland, and Germany. The official also noted that some 8,500 troops in the United States are on high alert. Also, another high-profile attendee in the 2022 Munich Security Conference, the British Prime Minister Boris Johnson, said Britain could block Russian companies from raising capital in London and has passed legislation to widen sanctions on Russian businesses and individuals if the country invades Ukraine. Johnson also stated that Russia would pay a heavy military price if it invaded Ukraine. Britain has already sent hundreds of troops to Poland to support NATO's eastern flank. However, the chairman of the Munich Security Conference, Wolfgang Eisinger, has highlighted the need for dialogue to resolve the differences. He said our world is in danger, traditional certainties are crumbling, threats and vulnerabilities are multiplying, and the rules-based order is increasingly under attack. He noted that the need for dialogue has never been greater. Meanwhile, Russia has time and again denied any intention to invade its western neighbor. It argues that it's deployed the military near Ukraine's borders to protect itself amid NATO's eastward expansion. Also, in a major step toward de-escalation, last week Moscow withdrew some of its troops near the Ukrainian border after completing military exercises. The U.S. President Joe Biden has ramped up his rhetoric against Russia amid mounting tension in Eastern Europe. He once again repeated his claim that Washington had intelligence showing his Russian counterpart, Vladimir Putin, has made up his mind to invade Ukraine.
We have reason to believe the Russian forces are planning to and intend to attack Ukraine in the coming week, in the coming days. We believe that they will target Ukraine's capital, Kyiv, a city of 2.8 million innocent people.
Speaking at the White House, Biden warned that war will close the window for diplomacy with Moscow. Biden also said Western countries won't deploy troops in Ukraine, but will continue to bolster their defensive capabilities. Earlier, the White House said Washington and its allies are working on a sanctions package in case of a Russian invasion. This is while Italy says the bans should not target energy imports from Russia. This could throw the EU economy into mayhem or even negatively affect Russia's gas supplies to Europe. The EU is Russia's biggest trade partner. Nearly 38% of Russia's exports went to the EU, while over 36% of Russia's imports came from Europe. Russia is also the origin of 26% of EU's oil imports and 40% of EU's gas imports.
I don't think Russia cares so much and worries so much about Western sanctions, because Russia proved for the years, in spite of Western pressure and different sanctions, capable to sustain and even improving slowly, not so good as before, its economy. So sanctions are not the main threat to Russia.
The U.S. accuses Russia of planning an attack on Ukraine, but Moscow says that is not true. Therefore, the latest warnings, based on unfounded accusations that a Russian invasion of Ukraine is just around the corner, would further complicate the situation at this critical time.
The Australian government announces a plan to blacklist the whole of Palestinian resistance movement Hamas. The country had previously designated Hamas's military wing, the Al-Qassam Brigades, back in 2003. Under the new restrictions, which will go into force in April, financing or providing any support to Hamas will be criminalized, with some offenses carrying a 25-year prison sentence. The reason for the blacklisting is what Canberra calls the group's, quote, hateful ideologies. But let's dive deeper and learn more about the Gaza-based group. Ever since Hamas scored a landslide victory in Gaza's parliamentary elections in 2006, it has been running the besieged enclave. Protecting the Strip has been one of the group's core responsibilities. Over the years, it has carried out the responsibility, the most recent instance of which came in May 2021, during the Israeli military's 11-day war on the Gaza Strip. The war killed some 250 Palestinians, including 66 children, but only 12 Israelis. If it weren't for the deterrent capabilities of the group, the number of Palestinian casualties would have been a lot higher. How would this justify branding the group as a terrorist organization? The case in point is that any group whose ideology goes against that of the U.S. and its allies is hit with such allegations. Hamas spokesman Hazem Qassem condemns Australia's decision to list the movement as a terrorist organization and calls on the Australian government to present an apology to the Palestinian people. He said the planned move attests to the biased support for the occupying regime and emboldens Israel to press ahead with its aggression against Palestinian people. The Islamic Jihad and the Popular Resistance Committees were also among Palestinian groups denouncing the decision. Voices of condemnation also came from inside Australia. The Australia-Palestine Advocacy Network, a national coalition of Australians who support Palestinian rights, disagreed with the designation, saying that it does nothing to advance the cause of peace and will only create more suffering for the 2 million people currently living under the 15-year Israeli blockade.
The word terrorist has been essentially coined and put into circulation by Zionists to demonize the people who are resisting their genocide in Palestine and the people all over the world who support that resistance. And in fact, the actual meaning of the word terrorism is deliberately targeting civilians to create fear or terror. And that is a military tactic that has been used since time immemorial by all sorts of different forces.
All in all, in the absence of any meaningful support for the people of Palestine and the condemnation of Tel Aviv,
Israel continues to commit gross violations and gets away with murder.
Fruitful Moments with IRIB English Radio.
Log on to our website, www.parstoday.com/en.
In the limelight.
Biden has become the third president to put royal ambitions before Yemeni lives. He and his officials should be held accountable for war crimes against Yemeni civilians, says Doug Bando, writer, in an article titled, Biden Administration Goes All In for Saudis and Emiratis. Stay tuned for more. Barely a year into the Biden administration, Riyadh and Abu Dhabi have captured U.S. West Asia region policy. President Joe Biden has abandoned the human rights principles he once claimed to hold dear. President Donald Trump also surrendered to the royals early, but never evinced the slightest humanitarian concern about foreign policy. His son-in-law Jared Kushner turned the administration's West Asia region portfolio over to the Saudis. Trump subsequently justified the sale of weapons as a massive jobs program, despite the thousands of people killed by those American bombs. After the murder of Saudi journalist and U.S. resident Jamal Khashoggi, Trump acted like a mob consigliere dedicated to protecting Crown Prince Mohammed bin Salman from justice. Better was expected of Biden. He sharply criticized MBS, promising to treat the latter as a pariah. Candidate Biden complained that Trump had written the Saudis a blank check. That seemed natural for a president who promised that human rights will be at the center of foreign policy. The Kingdom of Saudi Arabia's human rights record is one of the worst on earth. The KSA comes in about 10 out of 210 countries and territories with 7 of 200 points in the Freedom House Freedom in the World ranking. That puts it in territory occupied by North Korea, Eritrea, Equatorial Guinea, Turkmenistan, and other bottom-feeding dictators. Explained Freedom House, Saudi Arabia's absolute monarchy restricts almost all political rights and civil liberties. No officials at the national level are elected. The regime relies on pervasive surveillance, the criminalization of dissent, appeals to sectarianism and ethnicity, and public spending supported by oil revenues to maintain power. Women and religious minorities face extensive discrimination in law and in practice. Working conditions for the large expatriate labor force are often exploitative. Reports by Amnesty International, Human Rights Watch, Saudi human rights activists, and even the U.S. State Department tell a similar story. The United Arab Emirates also is rated not free, but comes in a bit higher at 17 points. Reported FH, limited elections are held for a federal advisory body, but political parties are banned, and all executive, legislative, and judicial authority ultimately rest with the 7 hereditary rulers. The civil liberties of both citizens and non-citizens, who make up an overwhelming majority of the population, are subject to significant restrictions. As President Biden promised to target U.S. support for the Yemen war, and for good reason, given the carnage resulting from 7 years of Saudi Emirati attacks on Yemeni civilians. The New York Times reported, year after year, the bombs fell on wedding tents, funeral halls, fishing boats, and a school bus, killing thousands of civilians and helping turn Yemen into the world's worst humanitarian crisis. In September, the UN group of eminent international and regional experts on Yemen issued its latest report. Since March 2015, over 23,000 airstrikes have been launched by the coalition in Yemen, killing or injuring over 18,000 civilians. Living in a country subjected to an average of 10 airstrikes per day has left millions feeling far from safe. According to the United Nations, UNICEF's Henrietta Fore reported that 2.6 million children are now internally displaced, deprived of healthcare, education, sanitation, and safe water. Yemen's gross domestic product, GDP, has dropped 40% since 2015. And despite the availability of food, 21 million people, including almost 11 million children, require humanitarian aid. The longer the conflict continues, the greater the harm. At risk, according to Martin Griffiths, UN Undersecretary General for Humanitarian Affairs and Emergency Relief Coordinator, are 5 million people are one step away from succumbing to famine and the diseases that go with it, and 10 million more are right behind them. A year ago, the president declared, "We are also stepping up our diplomacy to end the war in Yemen, a war which has created humanitarian and strategic catastrophe. This war has to end, and to underscore our commitment, we are ending all American support for offensive operations in the war in Yemen, including relevant arms sales." However, he exhibited dangerous confusion when promising to help Saudi Arabia and, by implication, the UAE, defend its sovereignty and its territorial integrity and its people. Yet, as noted earlier, Biden quickly adopted Trump's policy with his bizarre fealty to the West Asia region royals, destructive attack on the Yemeni people. What has been the consequence of Biden administration's embrace of the royal dictatorships? As the president passed his first anniversary in office, Saudi and Emirati attacks were up, killing even more civilians. Reported the Yemen Data Project, January 2022 was the most violent month in the Saudi-led air war in Yemen in more than 5 years. Yemen Data Project recorded 139 civilian deaths and 287 civilians injured in Saudi coalition airstrikes in January. taking the casualty toll to over 19,000 civilians killed and injured since Saudi Arabia launched its bombing campaign in Yemen in March 2015. Not since October 2016 have more civilian casualties been recorded in a single month in the air war. Saudi-led coalition airstrikes caused more civilian harm in the first month of 2022 than in the two previous years combined. Air raid numbers increased 60% month to month, from 250 in December to 401 in January, the highest monthly rate since March 2018, and the fifth consecutive month of rising bombing numbers. Monthly air raids have more than doubled since the UN Human Rights Council GEE mandate ended on October 31st last year, in a notable escalation in the conflict amid reduced accountability. The intensification of the bombing campaign in January included two air raids on hospitals, two water sites being bombed, 11 air raids on civilian vehicles, the bombing of a radio and TV station, a food truck, and a food storage unit. The U.S. should never have partnered with Saudi Arabia and UAE in their criminal attack on Yemen. The latter has suffered through violence most of its modern existence, but the U.S.-backed campaign multiplied the death and destruction visited upon the Yemeni people. Biden has become the third president to put royal ambitions before Yemeni lives. He and his officials should be held accountable for war crimes against Yemeni civilians.
Yusuf Jalali, Tehran.
Rubashavit, Gaza.
Jerome Hughes, Brussels.
Saeed Poreza, London.
Rasha Saglam, Istanbul.
Saeed Aminolemi, Kabul.
Shahana Bhatt, Indian administered Kashmir.
Round the world with reporters.
Under a sea of red flags, the Democratic Front for the Liberation of Palestine, DFLP, held a big protest to mark its 53rd anniversary and support Al-Quds. People thronged the streets of Gaza City to take part in the event. Protesters shouted slogans against the Israeli regime and vowed to stand with Al-Quds. Tensions heightened across the Palestinian territories in mid-February when Israeli forces and illegal settlers renewed their attacks against Palestinians in Al-Quds' Sheikh Jarrah neighborhood.
53 years on, the DFLP continues to hold sacred the liberation of Al-Quds and the right of return. And we will call on all Palestinians to protect Sheikh Jarrah.
The Democratic Front for the Liberation of Palestine refuses to recognize the Israeli regime and maintains armed resistance as the only way to end the Israeli occupation.
Resistance is the best way to liberate Al-Quds, and we say to our people in Sheikh Jarrah that we always support them. We are willing to sacrifice our lives for the sake of defending Al-Quds and all of Palestine against the Zionist enemy.
DFLP activists called on all Palestinian factions to increase armed resistance against the Israeli regime and its forces. Protesters also slammed Arab countries in the Persian Gulf region for normalizing their relations with Tel Aviv.
All those countries who normalize their ties with Israel are stabbing the Palestinian people in the back and hurting our cause. Israel is using normalization as a pretext to increase its violations in Al-Quds.
Palestinians stress that Al-Quds will always remain the capital of Palestine despite the U.S. and Israeli plots to change its status.
As they mark the 53rd anniversary of the DFLP, Palestinians in Gaza say they will continue to resist the Israeli occupation until the liberation of Al-Quds. Ashraf Shanan, Gaza.
EU Foreign Affairs Ministers held emergency talks on Tuesday to agree on sanctions against 351 Russian legislators who voted to give independence to two regions in eastern Ukraine. The West claims it's the beginning of an invasion. Russian financial, business and media outlets are also being singled out by the EU.
We agreed to target 27 individuals and entities who are playing a role in undermining or threatening Ukrainian territorial integrity.
The measures will result in asset freezes and travel bans.
We're limiting the Russian government's ability to raise capital on the EU's financial markets.
A new gas pipeline from Russia to Germany will, for now at least, remain closed. This despite the EU desperately needing Russia's energy. Citizens passing by the European Commission, the EU's executive arm, have clearly been following developments closely.
Ukraine, of course, has been generated as a state during the Soviet period, but in a way she's consists of several areas which are very difficult to be maintained together.
Yeah, we need peace. Our economy is based on international trade, and gas is one of our main tools to survive.
The European Commission confirmed on Tuesday EU gas reserve storage tanks are currently only 30% full. The Commission is actively trying to secure alternative supply chains in order to reduce the EU's dependency on Russia. It's in contact, for example, with Japan, South Korea, Qatar, Azerbaijan and Egypt. But this is a very costly process because the energy has to be shipped in. Russia's gas is cheap and, of course, the pipelines are already in place. NATO, which has its headquarters here in Brussels, continued to ramp up the anti-Russia rhetoric after the new sanctions were announced.
We have over 100 jets at high alert, and there are more than 120 Allied ships at the sea from the high north to the Mediterranean.
Many analysts say this crisis could have been avoided if NATO had listened to Russia's legitimate security concerns. Jerome Hughes, Brussels.
On Tuesday, the Italian Bureau of Statistics, Istat, announced Italy's inflation surged to 4.8% last month from 3.9% in December and is now at its highest since 1996. The statistical agency said its trolley index of everyday goods, such as food and household items, was up 3.2% with the Italians starting to buckle under the pressure. Price rises, Istat explained, were driven by higher energy costs.
Bread, milk, pasta, the price of every item has gone up considerably. I go shopping every day and it cannot go unnoticed.
Energy bills have gone up for a while and keeping the shop open is becoming unsustainable. In December I paid almost 100% more compared to the previous bill. I'm really concerned over what's happening in Ukraine. Should energy prices further hike, I would have to turn off the lights or shut off the shop.
Tension keeps growing at the border of the EU and Russia after Russian President Vladimir Putin issued a decree recognizing breakaway Luhansk and Donetsk regions in eastern Ukraine as independent. Western leaders have vowed to impose severe sanctions over Moscow aimed at limiting Russia's ability to export oil and gas. Italy's Prime Minister Mario Draghi has warned that any international sanctions targeting Russia's energy industry would hit Italy badly. Unlike other major European countries, Rome is very much gas-dependent, being the leading producer of electricity with this fuel in Europe.
Italy sources around 40% of its gas from Russia. As we are in February, with the warmer season fast approaching, the energy demand is set to drop a bit. It is to be hoped that the Ukraine crisis will be resolved in the next 6 to 7 months. In case it is not, the EU, which won't be self-sufficient in energy anytime soon, will have to find unity of purpose among its member states and embrace a more assertive energy strategy.
Rome has historically relatively strong commercial ties with Moscow. In recent days, Italy had announced plans for the possibility of Draghi flying to the Russian capital for talks over the Ukraine crisis with Putin. Max Civili, Rome.
The Ukraine crisis is entering a new phase as Russia recognizes the independence of two breakaway regions in eastern Ukraine.
I consider it necessary to make a long overdue decision to immediately recognize the independence and sovereignty of the Donetsk People's Republic and the Luhansk People's Republic.
Putin has also issued an order to deploy peacekeepers to Donetsk and Luhansk. Russia has already denied any plans to attack Ukraine or annex the two regions. The Russian president justified his decision by accusing the West of cheating Moscow and dishonoring their promise to stop NATO's eastward expansion.
They simply fooled us. We had five stages of NATO expansion, one after another. It has impacted very negatively on the nature of international relations and led to the loss of mutual trust.
Putin reiterated that Kyiv's admission to NATO would pose a major security threat to his country. The comments provoked Kyiv's reaction.
Ukraine unequivocally qualifies the recent actions of the Russian Federation as a violation of the sovereignty and territorial integrity of our state.
Hours later, the UN Security Council held an emergency meeting on the situation. Russia, Ukraine, and the U.S. clashed head-to-head at the meeting.
The internationally recognized borders of Ukraine have been and will remain unchangeable, regardless of any statements and actions by the Russian Federation.
What is more, this move by President Putin is clearly the basis for Russia's attempt to create a pretext for a further invasion of Ukraine.
We remain open to diplomacy for a diplomatic solution. However, allowing a new bloodbath in Donbass is something we do not intend to do.
Russia has warned Western powers to think twice and not worsen the situation, but the West's reaction was nothing other than critical remarks and threat of sanctions against Moscow. The Kremlin accuses Ukraine and the West of violating the Minsk agreements. It says the government in Kyiv is committing genocide in the Donbas region, while the West sends offensive weapons to the country. On the other hand, the West claims Russia intends to invade Ukraine. The Minsk agreements were signed in 2014 and 2015 to secure a ceasefire between the Ukrainian government and pro-Russian forces in the east of Ukraine. The Kremlin has repeatedly expressed concern about NATO's eastward expansion, demanding a ban on Ukraine's admission to the military alliance. So far, the U.S. and its NATO allies have only blown on calls by ignoring Russia's concerns and its requests for security guarantees.
People in the blockaded Gaza Strip staged a sit-in to support Palestinian prisoners languishing in Israeli jails and detention centers. During the sit-in, people shouted slogans against the Israeli regime and demanded the release of all Palestinian prisoners. Palestinian prisoners are political prisoners, and they are regarded as heroes and freedom fighters by all Palestinians.
The suffering of Palestinian prisoners has increased in recent months, especially following the bold escape operation in September. Prisoners, including women and children, suffer every day inside Zionist jails. The Zionist crimes against the prisoners must stop.
The sit-in comes at a time when hundreds of Palestinian detainees have been denied proper medical treatment in Israeli jails. Over 200 Palestinian detainees have died in Israeli prisons since 1967. During a press conference outside the Red Cross office, the Palestinian Ministry of Health condemned Israel's inhumane treatment of Palestinian prisoners, especially those suffering from chronic medical conditions.
For Palestinian inmates, Israeli prisons serve as gateways towards their death because of medical negligence. Currently, there are 700 very sick Palestinian prisoners inside Israeli prisons without proper medical care. Those sick prisoners are dying slowly as the world watches in silence.
Palestinian prisoners are held in 24 Israeli prisons and detention centers where they are denied basic human rights. Palestinian resistance movement Hamas demanded international protection for Palestinian prisoners.
We call on the Red Cross and all international organizations to help Palestinian prisoners, especially those who are sick in Zionist jails. We demand international protection for Palestinian prisoners. They are suffering because of the racist Zionist practices.
People here are calling on the international community to come out of its silence and help Palestinian prisoners.
According to prisoners' advocacy groups, there are thousands of Palestinian prisoners suffering in Israeli prisons under inhumane detention conditions. Ashraf Shanan, Gaza.
the third edition of the annual conference on Lieutenant General Qasem Soleimani, dubbed General Soleimani and New Islamic Civilization. The conference was held online this time, with 50 scholars and political pundits from across the world giving speeches.
General Qasem